Well, if you're not fully awake, I hope you will be by the time the presentation is over. I plan to present a bunch of eye-opening material. So it's wonderful that you're here. I was concerned, being Wednesday morning, that there wouldn't be anyone here. It's nice to see you. And my thanks to the program committee for accepting this presentation. It's an unusual presentation. So I'm an independent consultant, and I've been an independent consultant for over 30 years. But before that, I worked for 15 years with Massachusetts Civil Service, developing the validating exams there. And I've been reviewing tests in court for two decades, and noticed some logical gaps or flaws in some of our testing practices, some of which I probably did myself. And I have a long-standing interest in methods and techniques to reduce adverse impact, and some of that's on my website. And let's jump into this presentation. So I'm kind of going to present both new and largely overlooked ideas. And I'll start with a historic example that dates back over 100 years. Early in the 1900s, some top psychologists somehow made a ridiculous mistake that had a huge impact on our country for 50 years. Goddard, Terman, Bingham, Yerkes, Hall, Thorndike, the father of the younger Thorndike, all supported the eugenics movement, some more than others. And they, with the result of their new testing instruments, they decided that Italians and Jews were of low intelligence. And it led to the Restrictive Immigration Act of 1924, or contributed to it. And what was their flaw? They administered their IQ test in English to new immigrants who didn't really know English. And went whoosh, right over their heads. So the moral is, kick the tires on accepted wisdom. Now, they did have other data. They looked at the disease, illiteracy, poverty, and crime in immigrant neighborhoods, and they added that to the low intelligence, and they said, yeah, there's not a chance. Okay, let's look at a more contemporary example. So, for maybe two decades, we, at this conference, were telling people with certainty that assessment centers are much less valid than tests of general mental ability. And we did that because of the Schmidt and Hunter meta-analysis of 1998. And a few years ago, we had Paul Sackett here. Anybody hear Sackett's talk? And he said, you know, it's been bothering me for years that an assessment center lasting hours and hours and hours is less valid than a multiple choice test. And he said he finally analyzed the data more carefully, and he found that the multiple choice test validity coefficient is twice that of G. So that's a contemporary example. Okay, so the topics I chose, and there are more, appear to me to be fairly often seen, counterintuitive and illogical, not consistent with research data, and of practical import. For each of the topics, I'll mention the topic, describe the assumption, the logic or the data that challenges the assumption or presumption, and then we'll talk about it and talk about research needs and have some suggestions for immediate things that we could do, some of which involve this organization. Okay, first topic. When we use bar scales, we typically take a look at the reliability of the rater panel. And we use the Spearman-Brown formula and calculate alpha, which is a very simple calculation. And if we have high inter-rater reliability, we're happy. If we don't have it, we're unhappy, but we're happy. We think that means the board is doing a good job. By doing a good job, they're pretty accurately grading the candidates. Okay, the discordant data that I just ran across is that if you happen to have two panels rating each candidate independently, and you happen to have high reliability within each of the two panels, and you would expect, therefore, that the correlation between the grades on the two panels would be high, that's not necessarily what you find. So we had two rater boards who graded independently. The job exercise was presented via a recorded video. The candidates were recorded. The raters rated the recordings. So the two panels did exactly the same thing. They rated the candidates. So this was post-COVID. And there was surprisingly low correlation between the boards. So where you would have expected correlation between the boards to be in the 90s, sometimes it was in the 40s. Well, if it's in the 40s, so here we had 0.86 and 0.90 as the reliability within board one and board two. The observed correlation between the boards was 0.48. And it should have been at least 0.77. And all of the correlations between the boards were less than what you would have expected based on these two correlations.
What was the difference between exercise one and exercise two?
They were just two independent exercises on the same year. So this is data from two exams. They give this exam every other year, and the exam has, one of the components has two independent exercises.
Just seems that exercise one has a little bit more variability.
So, yeah, it was chance. So each one of the exercises was scored by different raters. So the two boards that scored exercise one were not the same two boards that scored exercise two.
I see.
You can maybe think about this pattern a little bit. What could cause high reliability within each of the boards, and then the two boards don't agree? So if one of the boards is doing it right, the other board wasn't. In any case, this low inter-board correlation calls into question the validity of both of the boards. Sometimes you did have reasonably high between board correlations. I only showed you two of the years like that from 10 of the years, and it's very similar. And I made a presentation of this on Monday, and that presentation's out on my website if you want to take a look at it. In terms of research needs, what's causing those differences? Is it the nature of the exercises, the natures of the dimensions, the anchors? Maybe the board members would be able to articulate what's causing the differences. Maybe what's happening is each board is using in part some invalid criteria or looking at invalid aspects of the answer. In terms of suggestions for immediate action, I think that one rater board is no longer a best practice. I think that the two rater boards should be routine. And you could then take a look at the results in your exams and see if the same thing is happening in your exams. And I'll give this website again later if you want to take a look at the, put it up at the end. Okay, next, 100 item test is long enough. And our assumption is that 100 item test gives you sufficient reliability and sufficient content validity. And the discordant data, I've seen test outlines with as few as one item per KSAP, sometimes two, sometimes three. So you're not going to get reliability with a one-item test, or even with a three-item test. And we've got a little bit more. So one published test, the PHR test, has 200 items and 57 knowledges. So that's 3.5 items per knowledge. So the reliability might be expected to be 0.4. If our 100-item test has an alpha of 0.95, working the Spearman-Brown prophecy formula backward, would mean that the average inter-item correlation is 0.16. So if we use that 0.16, alpha for KSAP with two items would be 0.28, with four items would be 0.43. Those are low correlations. So for those of you who want to look at the Spearman-Brown prophecy formula, this is the average inter-item correlation, and n is the number of items, and so that's the projected reliability of the whole exam. I think that if you try to measure a domain with so few items, you're going to have a lot of error, and you have no idea if the candidate has any competence in that area. And the uniform guidelines suggest that you should have, if you're going to measure a knowledge area, you should have a reasonably comprehensive measure of that area. Well, one or two items isn't a comprehensive measure of an area. So in terms of suggestions for immediate action, definitely have a minimum number of items per KSA, maybe 10 items. So 10 items would give you an alpha of 0.66, which isn't ideal, but it's a lot better than 0.2 or 0.3. And that probably means you're going to have more than 100 items on your test. And your goal is to have a reliable measure for each crucial KSAP. If the KSAP is really important, you should have a good measure of it. And that probably means you can't weight by number of items anymore. You have to find some other way of doing that. Okay, next. One overall score is sufficient, and one overall passing score is sufficient. Well, you can pass the exam with a zero on some KSAPs. Well, if your job analysis says that the KSAP is crucial, you really don't want to have people on the job without any knowledge of that KSAP. But you could do that. And the candidates are savvy, and they figure out, you know, which topics, over the years, they figure out which topics are emphasized on the exam and which not. And if you have an area that has one item or two items, they figure it out over time. And if that item comes from a book, this is one exam that came up in a court case, and they had a book that thing on police administration, and there's one item on it. Well, the judge thought it was just silly to have people read a whole book for one item, but the candidates also realized, I don't have to study that book. There's a better return on my study time investment than studying that book. I'll study the other books. So we could take a look at our own data and see how often that happens. So, as examples, you know, should an EMT who aces anatomy but fails CPR pass? Or should a police sergeant who knows no juvenile law be promoted? Should somebody be promoted to police sergeant who knows no juvenile law? Suggestions for immediate action. Be sure that your job analysis lets you identify the crucial KSAPs. If there are compensatory abilities, you can lump them together into one passing score. But if not, and you measure each KSAP reliably, this analysis suggests you should have a passing point for each crucial KSAP. We often try to have some situational multiple choice items because just knowledge of facts doesn't really tell you if you're going to be able to apply those facts. So we're happy with some situational items, and we think it's an improvement. And we try to measure the knowledge as it's used on the job. And memory items alone don't fare well in court. But consider this multiple choice item that I asked ChatGPT to write for me. You respond as a sergeant to a traffic collision involving two vehicles. One patrol officer is already on the scene and directing traffic. As you assess the scene, you notice skid marks leading to one of the vehicles that haven't been photographed. Second driver seems dazed, sitting on the curb. A civilian is recording the scene on a smartphone, and the officer looks overwhelmed, shifting between multiple tasks. And the question is, based on your observations, what is the most appropriate immediate action to take? A plausible situational item. But on the job, the sergeant would have to notice those facts. And at least half of the work of the sergeant is noticing what's going on. The item feeds you all the important information. So you're not testing the observational skills of the candidates, which is absolutely crucial. Another major problem is that the situational item, the multiple choice item, provides the right answer. And as we well know, it's a lot easier to recognize the right answer than to produce the right answer. So our situational items, even though we think they're an improvement, are not so great. We use the multiple choice items because they're easy, but it's becoming easier to develop video items. And Gen AI can help us create video items. We need a procedure for developing video items based on Gen AI, and we need to come up with criteria for evaluating the quality of video items. We could look at the research between traditional multiple choice tests and video items and try to figure out if AI can help us grade it. And we can consider both video items that are multiple choice and constructed response video items. So in terms of suggestions for immediate action, I think we should create an IPAC competition or award for students to come up with systems to develop video items with Gen AI. And I think we should have a Gen AI workshop at next year's IPAC on developing video items. And I think if we had that, it would be the most attended workshop that our conference has ever had. When we write our multiple choice items, we often pick up the words from the sources, from the SOPs, the textbooks, and our presumption, and I think it's an accurate presumption, is that if the item is appealed, we'll win the appeal. Because a candidate would say, you know, I don't like this item, and we'll say, gee, textbook said that, and the Civil Service Commission or whoever's adjudicating said, gee, you know, it's in the textbook, it's on the reading list, you should have written, you know, the item's okay. Even if the source wording is not clear, but often it is clear, so that's why we use it. The problem with quoting from the source is that often the items don't measure application of the knowledge. They don't measure understanding. Sometimes the source wording is unclear, and sometimes it's unclear if you take it out of context. So sometimes court cases get lost if the items test rote memory. On the other hand, the candidates say, how can I study for questions that ask about application, strategy and tactics? How do I study for strategy and tactics? I can read the SOPs and I can memorize the SOPs. So the candidates aren't happy when you deviate from the written material. But if you just test the written material, maybe you're testing the wrong thing. In terms of research, we have to figure out how to wean the candidates from memorizing and have them focus on application. And maybe that means that we have to train candidates for promotion. We now often just rely on the candidates training themselves. Well, it's not so easy to train yourself in lots of areas. So maybe we should partner with the departments more and have training programs, and then the training programs can produce the material on strategy and tactics and application, and then we could use it to develop the test questions. And then the candidates can't say, how should I know? Because it was in your training program. Also, maybe we should have a system for seeing how well our SMEs agree on the strategy and tactics. So in terms of suggestions for immediate action, I suggest always including a certain percentage of application items and understanding items on promotional exams. It might be, if you have civil service rules, that you could have a civil service rule that supports the use of SME judgment. So when the candidates say, how can you support this? You could say, well, we have this rule. And if we have agreement of X number of SMEs, we can use a situational judgment question, even though it's not in your source material. And again, I think the training courses for promotion are important. Okay, jumping around to a completely different topic, recruitment. So the presumption is doing more recruitment is good, and it will give you a more diverse workforce. If you want a diverse workforce, the recruitment people say, I'm going to go out there and do some serious recruitment, getting lots of people. And hopefully the hiring will reflect the makeup of the candidates. But it turns out that's not true. With more candidates, you're going to have more adverse impact. Your adverse impact will be worse when you have more candidates, presuming that the new candidates that you recruit are similar to the candidates you already had. So if your candidate pool was whatever, 10% minority, and you go and recruit twice as many people, again with 10% minority, your adverse impact is going to look terrible. And that's because you'll have a lower selection rate. And with a lower selection rate, a lower proportion of people hired, you're going to be picking people off the top of the tail of the distribution. And if the distributions for your minority and non-minority are different, you'll get a higher proportion of the non-minority candidates. And there will be fewer minorities in the top ranks. So smaller applicant pools will help your bottom EEO line. And if you're going to recruit, you have to recruit minority candidates who are better, not average. And if you're going to recruit more people and you want that to help your EEO posture, you have to recruit proportionally more minorities. If you don't recruit proportionally more minorities, the extra recruitment is going to be counterproductive. And effective recruitment is the easiest, most practical way to improve job performance. Talk about more in a little bit. So, in terms of research needs, we now focus on completely non-testing things like which recruitment sources are working the best. And we need to identify or find ways to recruit really high quality minority candidates and non-minority. So it's a good idea to focus on quality of applicants more than quantity. Focus on the mix of applicants. And as I said, we'll talk about this idea of recruitment being the easiest way to improve job performance in just a little bit. Okay, if anybody has any questions, I mean, there are many of you, just feel free to raise your hands. Another topic. We think that the people at the top of the list are the best people and they'll do the job reasonably well. And maybe not everybody recruit is all that good. Maybe we have a mixed bag of people we recruit, but at least we have the exam, the best people will float to the top, and we have a small selection ratio. So yeah, we have many too many candidates, but that's okay, because we'll pick out the cream of the crop and they'll be at the top of the list and they'll do the job well. The discordant data. It turns out that doesn't work in practice. And the reason it doesn't work in practice is that our validity is modest. So our validity is in the 0.25, 0.30 range, maybe even less. And we could look at what happens if we make some plausible assumptions. Let's assume that 50% of the applicants can do the job. Okay. And let's assume we're only selecting the top 10% on the exam score. Okay. And the result is that 71% of the people we hire, 71% of this 10% can do the job, but 29% of the people who hired can't do the job. Even though we're only hiring the top 10, and even though 50% of the candidates can do the job, of the applicants can do the job. When we actually do the math, 30% of them, 29%, the people that you hire can't do the job. So we can look at that same example with a validity of 0.3 in the top 10% hired. Only 22% of the people who are hired are in the top 10% on the job. Now, they're all in the top 10% on the exam score, because that's how we chose them. But only 22% are in the top 10% on the job. We have a high level of false negatives, people who can do the job well who aren't hired. 3% of the people who are hired are in the bottom 10% on job performance. Oh my goodness. Most of the people who are on the top 10% on the job performance aren't hired. The problem is that you have modest predictive validity, and that 0.3 just dooms you to that outcome. It's worse than that, because they're often critical KSAPs that you're not measuring. Well, goodness knows how many of your candidates have any competence on those KSAPs that you're not measuring. So often, exams for police officer don't measure memory of faces or recognition of faces in new situations. Well, that's what cops do out there in the world. They see a picture and they have to pick somebody out on the street. Well, they're not sitting in the same posture with the same clothes and the same expression. None of our questions get at that. I don't know why. So I made a presentation at an IPAC conference some years ago, and the conference was bigger and I had a bigger audience. And I said, I have a test that does that, and I'll let you use it for free if you let me have the data. And anyone who wants to talk about it, let me know. Not a single person in the audience had contacted me. And then we still have this issue about the compensatory grading. So somebody who's very low on a crucial KSAP isn't hired, so that model that I talked about doesn't include consideration of that. And sometimes the people who pass don't score very high. So you might have a promotional exam and have two or three candidates, and one candidate scores in the low 70s and the others fail. That person in the 70s is going to be promoted, even though they didn't get a very good score. That's the discordant data.
Sorry to interrupt. Is all of that data, that research that you were just talking about, is the context within law enforcement hiring, or what was the context of that research?
The Monte Carlo analysis doesn't consider the subject matter. The average validity of our exams is, in the nicest meta-analyses and the most favorable meta-analyses, it's 0.3. In Sackett's meta-analysis, it was 0.22 was the average validity for our multiple choice test. So it doesn't matter what the job title is. That low validity dooms us to that dismal hiring. So how do you... Okay. There are two possible approaches to improve the hiring, the people who are hired. One is to have more valid tests. Boost that 0.3 up to 0.4. Unfortunately, we've been trying to do that for decades, and we haven't been very good at it. Now, maybe we can do better at it with the AI-generated situational items, but the easier way to improve the hires is to recruit better candidates. So if 90% of your applicants can do the job and you hire randomly, 90% of them will succeed. And if you have a little validity, it'll be more than 90%. If 10% of your candidates can do the job, of the people you hire, something over 10% will succeed because the validity will boost it up a little bit over 10%. The easiest way to improve job hires is to recruit better candidates. And probably not necessarily easy, but I think it's easier than improving validity, which I think we should be working hard at. Research needs. Which recruitment sources give you the best candidates? In terms of suggestions for immediate action, again, focus on quality of candidates, not quantity. See if we could figure out ways to improve predictive validity. I think training for promotion, at least in police departments, but maybe other promotional exams, is a good idea. That would mean that more of the candidates can do the job well. And I think we should pay more attention to criterion-related validity studies. I think whenever we get over maybe 300 people or so that we hire, maybe over a several-year period, we should plan to do a criterion-related validity study. Now, some long time ago, the feds provided funds to support that, particularly in law enforcement. So a lot of the early research in law enforcement was funded not internally, but by the feds. And I think that we should try to lobby for more funding for validation research. So PSYOP doesn't do much political action. APA does. APA is more active. I don't think PSYOP is going to change, but maybe some of our members are APA members, and maybe we could at least approach APA, and I'm sure APA knows how to lobby, and does lobby, and has lobbyists, and paid lobbyists, because it's a great big
PSYOP has paid lobbyists.
Pardon?
PSYOP does have paid lobbyists.
Okay.
There is a group that works for PSYOP that lobbies.
So maybe approach both organizations.
Yeah.
And see if we could get that on their radar. Okay, you come to our conferences, you will hear repeatedly, our tests are fair. And if any unfairness exists, we are overestimating the job performance of minority takers a little bit. So if we're doing anything unfair, it's not hurting minorities because we're over-predicting job performance for minorities. Well, that's a very comforting thing to be able to say. You know, it's unfortunate we have adverse impact on many of our exams, but we know our exams are good. They're fair. They're and valid. Well, that's based on the Cleary definition of test fairness. And the Cleary definition of test fairness asks, are the slope and intercept the same for various groups? And if that regression line is the same for various groups, we say there's no differential prediction, there's no predictive bias based on group membership, and this sounds very convincing, very comforting, and we're happy. But we shouldn't be. Here are a few reasons why we shouldn't be. The Cleary definition presumes that our measures of job performance are fair, unbiased. Well, if our measures of job performance are biased and we are accurately predicting the biased measures of job performance, what does that say for our tests? And there are indications that job performance measures are biased. So, for example, men are paid more than women. Well, we're not saying that men are smarter and brighter and work better. Tall people are paid more than short people. Well, no one's saying that short people are stupid and lazy. Attractive people are paid more than homely people, both male and female. This accurate predictions of unfair criteria, it calls into question the use of the Cleary definition. But there's more. We should more discordant data. The Cleary method, which asks about the same regression line, relies on a statistical test for differences in slope. Well, the statistical test for differences in slope has low power. So you can have unfair tests and your statistical test doesn't notice it because you have low power. And one of our foremost researchers in the field, Herman Aguinas, did some research on larger data sets, and he found differential prediction. But that's not all. There's more reason to question that our tests are fair. There's another definition of fairness by Thorndike. That's the son of the Thorndike who mentioned earlier. And he says Cleary is asking the wrong question. Thorndike asks, if you have candidates who are equally qualified, will the same proportion of those equally qualified candidates be promoted? It's a similar question, but it's not the same question. And the mathematics are a little complicated, but you could have a test that's perfectly fair under the Cleary definition and still equally qualified members of different groups will not be selected at the same rate. The 1999 APA standards, which I guess are better called the joint standards, say that. It says, in their discussion of fairness, among qualified candidates, the selection rate will be smaller for the group that has the lower mean. That sentence disappeared in the later versions of the standards, not because it's wrong, just that we have coalesced on the Cleary definition. Looking at it a little differently, the black-white difference in mean test score difference is about twice as big as the difference in job performance. On the test, the black and white difference in means is that big, and on the job, the black and white difference on job performance is that big. But we're making hiring decisions based on this. The Thorndike definition says we have a problem, but the field has coalesced over the Cleary definition. Looking at it pictorially, and I plucked this out of a journal article, so I didn't replicate the numbers, but I presume the journal article was right. It was in a competent journal. If you, for this arbitrary passing point, 25% of the minorities will pass, and if that's the point where you decide who's hired, 25% will be hired. But in terms of job performance, if you take those same people, 40% of the minority group could do the job. So you're promoting 25, but 40% could do the job. So Thorndike would say, that's not fair. But our profession says that that's fair. So the Cleary definition favors the testing profession, was accepted by the testing profession. It ignores the research on criterion contamination. It ignores another logical definition, and it's never been adjudicated in court. Well, we accept the Cleary definition, but if a court were to see the presentation I just presented, they might not go with the Cleary definition. So saying that our tests are fair in general is simplistic and maybe wrong. In terms of research needs, I think we should take another look at the definitions of test fairness. We should see if we could think of ways of implementing the Thorndike definition. We could see what under what conditions could we meet both definitions of fairness, and perhaps we could somehow encourage some presentations at next year's conference to look at test fairness. And in terms of immediate action, we could perhaps try using more than one definition. When we're using the Cleary definition and we're doing tests of slope and intercept, we could calculate power. And I think that we will get into maybe focusing on utility more than validity. And I think that that's a topic for another presentation, maybe at next year's conference, We focus almost completely on validity, but I think we should be focusing on utility. And we come up with different decisions as to what tests to use and what KSAPs to use if you focus on utility over validity. A couple more topics, and we have 10 minutes, so I'll zip through it. We think incumbents are good SMEs, and that they'll tell us what KSAPs are needed, but the SMEs don't know anything about KSAPs. They've never read the published literature on KSAPs. They don't understand the Fleischmann errors. They don't know anything about personality factors. They don't know nothing about values. Few police officer exams test face memory. Few exams measure creativity, because SMEs just don't think of that when they're coming up with the KSAPs. And there is some bias. The SMEs tend to tell you that the things they know are important, and the things they don't know aren't important. Well, that's self-serving. The KSAP lists you find from different police departments, for example, are different. The KSAPs that appear in the literature often don't appear on the SME lists. Executive function is often omitted. Big five areas, subsets of the big five areas, low D KSAPs, the KSAPs that have less adverse impact are omitted, such as creativity. So Sackett did a review of 100 years of research and integrity, achievement motivation has been in the literature for decades, easily measured, important for job performance, and we don't pay any attention to it at all on our exams. I mentioned creativity, vocational interest is ignored on our entry-level exams. We ignore work in other fields of psychology. We avoid selective attention. We avoid processing information. I don't know where this idea came from of using incumbents to help us identify KSAPs. And I thought it must be in a landmark Supreme Court case, and it's not. And it's not in any other case. Back in the 90s, when test development research was going on, Goldstein and two colleagues recommended using supervisors for KSAPs rather than incumbents, because supervisors have to try to figure out why their incumbents aren't doing well. And I think the trainers are better at KSAPs than incumbents. So in terms of what research we could do, I think that we should have a list of KSAPs compiled from the literature. We should go beyond the IO literature. Most of our KSAPs have been used for over 100 years, but they're wrong, but there are things that we're missing. I think we can compare KSAPs that we get from incumbents and supervisors and trainings. I think we could come up with a list of KSAPs that are measured with different test modes rather than have everybody decide that on their own. I think IPAC can help. I think we could have an IPAC bank with definitions of KSAPs. And I think that there are several other things we should do. We should take a look at our job analysis results, and where the SMEs don't agree, we should probe and see why they're not agreeing. But we don't do that very much. I think this is the last topic, which is good, because it's the last 5 minutes. We have, I think, a gut feeling that D's average. So D's are the differences in group means. So if the mean differences differ by one standard deviation, the D would be 1. If the means are the same, the D would be 0. And our intuitive idea is that if you take a component that has considerable adverse impact, a D of 1, and you add in a component that has no adverse impact, say a D of 0, the composite will have a D of 0.5. But that's not true. And in case you want a definition of D, it's the mean of one group minus the mean of the other group over the pooled standard deviation. And for example, the Sackett in 22 said that the D for structured interviews was 0.23, for general tests and mental ability was 0.79, for conscientiousness was minus 0.07. And I'll give you the formula for the pooled standard deviation. It's on the IPAC website and my website. But Sackett and colleagues have taught us that if you add a D of 1 and D of 0, you don't get a D of 0.5, but a D of 0.7. So adding in that low D component helps, but not as much as you might have thought. And even if you get your D down to 0.2, which is considered a modest D, with 0 being no difference, 0.2 can cause severe adverse impact. So the mathematics of adverse impact is a little subtle, not always intuitive. So if you want to see what your output is going to be before you give your exam, you have to do an actual mathematical prediction. And maybe there's a research need, maybe a D calculator to help in predicting overall D would be helpful. The Sackett article has some tables. And often we use a pass-fail on a test with high D, and we might want to take a look at the effect of that pass-fail on utility. And I'll mention just utility a little bit. Utility is the benefit of using the test minus the cost. And the cost is the cost of test development and administration, but usually it's minimal. Utility isn't discussed much in the principles or the standards, but the level of job performance is what utility is all about. Utility is how much does the use of the test improve job performance? And mathematically, there are three things that go into improving job performance, and we've talked about some of them. Validity is one of them. A higher valid test will be better job performance, but a smaller selection ratio will give you better job performance, and better candidates will give you better job performance. In terms of suggestions for immediate action, calculate your D for each test and test area. Calculate the utility for the test. Consider using a pass-fail approach if you have measures with large D, but look at utility. And global suggestions. I think that testing agencies might benefit from having a advisory board, and you can get advisory people from colleges and universities. Testing departments should fund a research position. We should lobby Congress for federal funding, as was available some decades ago. And IPAC, I think, could do a lot to help us advance the profession. And there's a IPAC member forum that's not much used, but it's on the website. You go to the IPACweb.org, you click on the three light dots at the top of the menu bar, go to members only, and then there's an IPAC member forum, and you can talk to other members of IPAC. And if you're not signed up, sign up, and then you'll get a little notification whenever somebody puts a note there. So the field we're in is still young. Many improvements are possible, and many topics need more research. And that's my contact information, and that's where I hope an audio recording, as well as the slides, will be available on my website. And I didn't leave much room for questions. Yes?
I was wondering if we could go back to where the dean worked with structured interview and everything.
That one?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's Sackett 2022, and I have a full set of references on my website, and it'll be on the IPAC website, and you can find the full citation to that article. And if you have any desire to talk about any of this at any time, feel free to send me a note or call me up. I'd be happy to chat. I'd be interested in hearing some of your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you.